From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, as the legislature hammers out a budget, will they nail down those big tax loopholes? The gun debate continues in D.C., but in Texas, there's little debate over school teachers packing heat in the classroom. And it's the dark and gritty film classic that made John Wayne more than a silver screen cowboy, looking for the reality behind the searchers.
So we'll find them in the end, I promise you. We'll find them. Just as sure as the turning of the earth.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Texas legislature continues to grind out the next state budget. That means the lawmakers are puzzling where those precious state dollars will flow, but they are also working on who gets a sweetheart deal when it comes to paying taxes. Those tax loopholes cost the state billions of dollars, and there's a growing chorus for greater transparency in letting the public know who gets them and why. Philip Martin of Progress, Texas says many of the tax loopholes are shrouded in mystery.
Most Texans don't know about some of the loopholes that we actually have to pay for. So what we want to do is educate Texans about some of the worst loopholes out there and pass a bill that allows us to find all of them so that we can start bringing in more revenue to invest in our state.
So loopholes usually may have a lobbyist attached to them, and they're able to work the legislature in closed doors and at these power lunches and give contributions to lawmakers so they can keep these loopholes and to keep them out of the public eye.
Yeah, exactly. One of the worst loopholes is a natural gas exemption for high-cost drilling. It's a 20-year-old law that was in place when we were just starting our natural gas drilling, but it's not doesn't need to be there anymore. We lose about $1 billion every year because of this loophole, and we need to close it. We need to close that one. We need to find the other loopholes that are out there and close them. Because we're losing money to our schools, we're losing money to our healthcare and our water systems and our roads, all because of these loopholes. So we got to close them.
Just take a look at that example that you brought up about the natural gas drilling loophole that allows these drillers to write off their expenses. If we took that away, then the natural gas would probably get real expensive, wouldn't it?
Well, I think that we might see some of the profits that these natural gas companies would have to find a way to make do with a few, you know, $1,000 less of the millions they make every year. But it would make a big difference for the people of Texas. And the reality is most of these loopholes aren't necessary. When you look at the state's legislative budget board, the people that make recommendations on how we should appropriate money in our state, they think that we can just do a reduction in the loophole, not end it entirely, but just reduce it so they don't get as big a tax break. And that would show that the companies would still be able to make money, we'd still be able to drill, energy prices would stay the same, and we'd have more money for our schools with slightly modifying that exemption.
So, but when it comes to loopholes, are these things that are really business related? Are they, I mean, we don't have like, you know, loopholes for country clubs and yachts, do we?
We actually do. There's a 40-year-old law in Texas that says that country clubs don't have to be assessed the full value of their property. This is actually a loophole that the House Ways and Means Chairman, who is in control of writing our state's tax laws, didn't even know about until the last few months. And that's one he's looking to close as well. So there's a lot of loopholes out there that we don't even know about, that aren't necessary, and that are just kind of on the books because they're there. And what we want to do is to go through and find those loopholes and really scrub the tax code. You know, every 2 years we review the budget, we make sure every appropriation is necessary. We should do the same thing with our tax laws and make sure every single loophole and exemption is actually needed. Find the ones that aren't needed and end them.
Is this something that's attracting bipartisan support?
It has. We're asking Texans to go out there and support Senate Bill 140, which is a bipartisan bill by Senator Rodney Ellis, a Democrat from Houston, and Senator John Corona, a Republican of Dallas. And the two of them together have recognized that we need more revenue in our state, and one of the best things we can do is close existing loopholes to ensure that we have enough money to invest in Texas. So this is a bipartisan bill that I think Democrats and Republicans can get behind because nobody wants to see their tax dollars go to waste.
And what is the Walmart loophole?
Well, the Walmart loophole is a loophole that says corporations who pay their taxes on time get a tax break. And I think this one is really one of the worst because, you know, tax day is just around the corner. I'm not going to get a tax break because I pay my taxes on time. So why should a corporation? We shouldn't reward people for doing what the law says they're supposed to do. But the Walmart loophole does just that. I think that's one of them that we really should take a hard look at ending.
Why is it called the Walmart loophole?
Walmart and a bunch of lobbyists who represent Walmart and other large retail stores have really pushed for this. They made arguments in past years that it was so burdensome and for them to fulfill all their tax obligations that they, in order for them to do it on time, they should be a little bit of incentive. Now, the reality is, with modern technology, we can run our books and pay our taxes on time just fine. I can pay my taxes from my phone. I'm sure Walmart has enough money to pay their taxes on time without needing any extra funds.
So this is a bill that's working its way through the legislative process right now, but it needs more support?
It does. It's been heard in the state Senate, and the House Ways and Means Chairman has promised to give it a hearing pretty soon as well. But it's, you know, it's a tough one. There's a lot of lobbyists who are going to be against this because, as you said, every lobbyist, you know, wants to protect their little slice of pie. But we need to get a bunch of Texans out there to recognize what's actually going on, the exemptions that are there, so that we can close these loopholes and try to make sure this bill makes it through the legislative process.
Philip Martin is with Progress Texas. He says Texas loses $43 billion each budget cycle due to tax loopholes and exemptions. Progress Texas is calling for changes to the state tax system to plug those loopholes. The Tesla Roadster is one of the hottest cars on the road, critically acclaimed, sleek, and electric. If you want to buy one of these battery-powered beauties in Texas, you're going to have some problems. There is no actual Tesla dealership in the state. There are two Tesla galleries, one in Austin and Houston, but under Texas law, Tesla employees cannot discuss purchasing, financing, or leasing one of those vehicles. They cannot tell customers the price of a Tesla vehicle or how they might reserve one. They cannot offer test drives or refer customers to out-of-state stores that do any of those things. Tesla is trying to change that law. Dermud O'Connell is Tesla VP of Corporate and Business Development.
We have an ardent base of fans in Texas. We have sold some of our cars. We have about 400 vehicles on the road in Texas. They were bought by Texans. Unfortunately, they've had to buy them from operation in California because of the constraints of Texas law. In response to their concerns about service and with a desire to sell more of our cars in Texas, we have we're pursuing a narrow exception to the existing franchise dealer laws. As commemorated in the occupation code. We started the effort maybe about a month ago, and we're actively pursuing it. The odds are long because the Texas Auto Dealers Association is a very strong organization and is very jealously protecting the rules as they exist, but we are very hopeful. We've found a lot of supporters in the legislature and in Texas generally.
You know, your boss, Elon Musk, he's like the prototype for Iron Man and is able to launch rockets into space and billionaire and just all-around amazing guy. But he's kind of met his match with the Texas legislature.
I wouldn't say that exactly. Elon is an incredibly determined individual. One of his great strengths is he simply doesn't give up. The truth is, however, we've found a number of supporters in the Texas legislature. I would say that our primary, the folks that we are having difficulty engaging with are the Texas Auto Dealers Association. We have made it very clear that we would be open to a discussion with them about a compromise that would serve their purposes as well as ours, but they have refused any dialogue with us on the subject. So that's really the adversary the adversarial relationship here. With respect to the legislature, we found a number of folks who are very sympathetic to what we're trying to do and have been quite helpful in helping us to pursue what we're trying to get done.
Why not open traditional Tesla-type dealerships in Texas?
Well, there are a number of reasons. First of all, the mission for our company is to catalyze the market for electric vehicles. Electric vehicles are an innovative technology, and they require a great deal of education of the consumer who's trying to make a choice, a significant choice, between the traditional gas-powered vehicle and an electric vehicle. This requires a no-pressure environment where a consumer can come in and really understand the technology and not be pushed to buy a vehicle. And that's how we set up our stores in other states, and that's how we set up our galleries. in Texas. We, by the way, have a gallery in Austin at the Domain and Houston in the Galleria. The other reason is another reason is that electric vehicles have always suffered whenever they've been sold side by side with gas-powered vehicles because the dealer system and salespeople themselves are incented to move the metal, and because it's a more considered purchase, as I said, it takes a little bit more time. The other element is that while it might be simple, while it might be easy and in fact cheaper to set up a franchise system for us in Texas, there would be no guarantees that we would sell any vehicles, because when one sets up a franchise agreement, there is no obligation on the side of the franchisor to sell the vehicles. And so it's quite likely, in fact, almost certain, that we would be assigned the back of the bus position in any retail context. So it's for all those reasons, and consistent with our mission to really push this technology forward and build momentum around electric vehicles, that we believe that this is the only way that we can go to market, and why we're doing this everywhere else in the country.
I heard that you are considering a factory in Texas if you're able to get laws changed so that you can sell the vehicles in Texas.
Elon, I mean, the car business is a long-term proposition. Elon has expressed recently that as we expand, and frankly, the view at with Tesla is to move from the Model S to ever more economical vehicles. We want to do a $30,000 high-volume vehicle within the next couple of years. But Elon's also talked about producing an EV version of a pickup truck, which we think would be a great product for the Texas market. And clearly, we're going to have to expand our manufacturing operations. So he has certainly opened up the possibility that if we do that going forward, that Texas would be an obvious choice.
So this would be a four-wheeling, off-road electric vehicle that I could throw hay bales and salt licks out the back of?
Well, we haven't spec'd it out in great detail right now, but I think it would be something that would be competitive with the mainline pickup truck that is most popular in Texas. I've spent some time down there, especially of late, and have noticed a plethora of four-wheel drive, crew cab type vehicles, and so it would be logical for us to make something that hit the sweet spot in the market.
Dermot O'Connell is Tesla Motors VP for Corporate and Business Development. He testified before a Texas Senate committee about changing the Texas law so that Tesla cars could be sold in the state. Ever since the 1999 Columbine school shooting, there's been a great concern about the vulnerability of our schools. But with the horror of the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary, folks are desperate to find solutions to prevent another shooter from going berserk on campus. In Texas, there's a growing number of schools allowing qualified teachers and staff to carry firearms. Patrick Michaels writes about this for the current issue of the Texas Observer.
One school district before the shooting that did have a policy in place. Basically, you just have to have the school board's approval locally to do it. And now there have been, by my latest count, 8 more districts that have some kind of program or policy that they're putting into place to let teachers carry. And they're all kind of doing it separately, and it's just kind of spreading, you know, one at a time as they get this idea. But they're all small districts, you know, often far from police. Just kind of thinking about, well, if this thing happened to us, what would we do? And this is the answer they've come up with.
Yeah, the Harold School District in Harold, Texas, they were on the forefront of arming their teachers, or allowing them, if they had passed the concealed handgun class, to bring their concealed handguns to school. And Harold said they were so small that they couldn't afford a security guard, and they felt that this would be an effective deterrent for some sort of tragic shooting.
That's it. And, you know, there's our cover story in the Observer this month is a photo set on school districts where this is happening, and gun training for teachers in districts where they're at least considering it. And one of the guys in there was a superintendent in Jonesboro, And you know, his thought was that, you know, that this would just be something to buy them time. You know, if the police were on their way and there was a shooter in the school, that this would be something that they could at least defend themselves or keep things, you know, drawn out as long as possible until the police were there. And to hear him tell it, one of the most important things was training teachers how to stand down once the police do show up and kind of make it clear that you know, you're not the shooter, you're the teacher with a gun trying to protect the kids.
So I know that some concealed handgun instructors in Texas are providing free instruction for school teachers or faculty and staff at schools in case they want to join this policy.
Yeah, there was a huge one just last Sunday, 700 teachers, I think, in a free class. And it's something that I think a lot of CHL class providers see as like an opportunity to step out and do something that they think is important at this time. And at the same time, at the Capitol, there are some bills that are working their way through that would you know, provide state funding for a new kind of class just for teachers to use guns in a an active shooter situation, and another one that would create a new type of security position that's a school marshal, that's a teacher or an administrator that is trained, you know, for I think 80 hours to have a gun around campus.
But people wonder what this will do to the classroom atmosphere if students know that the teacher is armed.
Sure. I mean, you can think of a million different kind of nightmare scenarios or, the gun gets loose or somebody grabs it or, the superintendent in Jonesboro I was talking about said, you know, they're picking who's going to be part of their guardian angel program. And there were some names that they thought of that, well, certainly it's not going to be this one, or sure, it's not going to be this person. Like, you just kind of know they're not going to be the ones you want armed in school. And you're leaving these really tough decisions up to the folks who run the schools. But, you know, one of the surprising to me things, looking around what's happening at the Capitol, is that, you know, these things are just sailing through. There's not a whole lot of resistance to any of these measures.
A lot of people point to this one incident that happened earlier in the year in a Michigan school where a security guard left his gun in a restroom at the school, and it was found by a student, and the student turned it in and nothing bad happened. But they see that as like, well, you know, when you bring guns into a school and they don't always end up in the hands where you want them to be.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, you're just kind of upping the stakes that much more, and that's one of the strongest arguments against these policies.
You know, and you can also look at the irony that there are people who say that, you know, the teachers are indoctrinating our students when they don't like what they're teaching, and then now some people are trying to arm the teachers. How do we know that the guns are going to the right teachers?
Yeah, well, it's up to local control, and it's up to the superintendent and whoever's running the gun program at that campus to make sure that it's happening right. And, you know, I guess you'll hear about it, you know, if there's a problem or if somebody makes the wrong decision, but it's up to the local district. And I think what you're getting at there is really kind of key, is that whenever there's a big kind of cultural moment here, that the schools are one of the first places that you look for it to play out, you know, whether it's, you know, debates about, science or sex ed or history or you know, it's, you know, because the language is just so strong. This is the future of Texas we're talking about. The fights get that much tougher around the schools.
And we really have to ask ourselves, are armed teachers really going to be a deterrent to an active shooter?
Absolutely. And I'm not sure that we have an answer to that right now. I mean, every time there's a school shooting, we have this fight, and every time there's a school stabbing, we have, you know, a different kind of fight about it. And you'll just kind of keep gathering your evidence until you're satisfied.
Patrick Michaels is a reporter for the Texas Observer. He wrote the text for a photo essay about school teachers qualifying for concealed handgun permits so they can be ready to fight off a campus active shooter.
From the thrilling pages of life rides a man you must fear and respect. A man whose unconquerable will and boundless determination carved a lusty, rough, and boisterous slice of history called the Searchers. It's John Wayne as Ethan Edwards, who had a rare kind of courage. The courage that simply keeps on and on, far beyond all reasonable endurance, never thinking of himself as martyred, never thinking of himself as brave.
John Ford's 1956 film, The Searchers, is one of the greatest of the director's career. Set in Texas, it's about one man's seven-year quest to find his niece, who'd been abducted by Comanche Indians. John Wayne stars as Ethan Edwards, a man whose hatred of the Comanches is so strong, he doesn't just want to kill them all, he wants to damn their spirits for eternity.
Why don't you finish the job?
What good did that do you?
By what you preach, none. But what that Comanche believes, ain't got no eyes, he can't enter the spirit land. Has to wander forever between the winds. You get it, Reverend. Come on, blanket head.
The film may be famous, but what is less well known is that The Searchers is based on real Texas history. In 1836, 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker was stolen from her family in a Comanche raid. Glenn Frankel's new book, The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend, is as much about the history behind the film as the making of the movie itself. Frankel spoke to Texas Public Radio's Nathan Cohn from the KUT studios in Austin.
Well, the basic story is pretty simple. A 9-year-old girl is with her extended family. They've settled in sort of central eastern Texas on a fortified farm. And one day in May of 1836, a group of Kiowa and Comanches come along, and an attack occurs. 5 people are killed, including her father and her grandfather, and 5 young people are captured, including 9-year-old Cynthia Ann. She spends 24 years with the Comanches. She marries a Comanche. She has 3 Comanche children. And then one day in December 1860, another group of raiders come to the village she's living in, only this time it's U.S. Cavalry and Texas Rangers. And people around her, the dear ones, are killed again. She and her little daughter, Prairie Flower, a baby, are captured. And, you know, and it seems like they're about to kill her. She looks like a Comanche woman, but then they notice she has blue eyes. And so they take her back to Camp Cooper. They figure out along the way this must be Cynthia Ann Parker. She's already sort of a known mythic figure, you know, in Texas history. They get in touch with her family, and she's restored to the Parker family. The only problem is, of course, that she's become a Comanche. She doesn't want to be back with Texans. She doesn't want to be embraced in Christendom. She wants to be back with the Comanche family, with her sons, with her husband, with her village. And so it becomes a very tragic tale. For the second time, she's been the traumatized victim of the Comanche-Texan wars.
And in the meantime, people have been looking for her.
Her uncle, James, who had been on the settlement, who had escaped the attack, comes searching for her and the other 4 young people who'd been captive. And he manages over time to get the other 4 back, but he never gets Cynthia Ann back. It's 8 years on and off that he searches for her. He writes a narrative of his own account. And, you know, James is telling the story both to justify what he's done and who he is. So immediately, right from the start with Cynthia Ann, you have people coming along, taking the basic story, embellishing it a bit, changing parts of it to fit their needs and their sensibility.
So in the movie, Ethan Edwards, played by John Wayne, and he really hates the Comanche. There's a lot of critical writing since The Searchers came out that explicitly talks about his racial hatred of the Comanche. What are some of the differences between James Parker, the real-life uncle of Cynthia Ann Parker, Amos Edwards in the novel, and the way it eventually became Ethan Edwards, really the role of John Wayne's career, a terrific role?
Yes, I agree with you. It really is an amazing role. Anyone who thinks that John Wayne wasn't an actor, I would ask you to watch The Searchers and then see if you still have the same opinion. Well, you know, it begins with James Parker, who's a sort of devout religious person, but at the same time turns out to be a kind of heavy drinker. He's a bit of an outlaw. He says he knows Indians and understands Indian lore, but he's very unsuccessful, and the narrative he leaves behind is a bit self-pitying. we move on, you know, to the novel and then to the film. What the film does is take this man and really raise him to the surface. He becomes the most powerful figure in the movie because he's being played by John Wayne, but he's a dark figure. And what happens over the course of the movie that's so fascinating is he starts out trying to rescue his 9-year-old niece. But as time goes on, she grows from being a little girl to being a young woman. And over the 7 years, and she becomes a Comanche wife. And his quest over time turns into, you know, changes. It morphs. Originally, he's trying to rescue her. But as time goes on, he decides he's going to kill her. And that becomes the sort of narrative tension that drives the movie forward. What's going to happen when Uncle Ethan finally catches up with this little girl? Is he really going to kill his niece, or is something else going on? And John Wayne does a beautiful job of capturing all of the conflict that's going on within Ethan Edwards as to what to do. On one level, he's sure he has to do this terrible deed. He becomes this dark knight who, rather than rescue the damsel, he decides he's going to kill the damsel. At the same time, though, we're never quite sure what he's going to do. He's still John Wayne, after all. He's very charismatic. We want him to succeed. But at the same time, we recoil from his mission. And it's that tension that really drives the movie forward.
Finally, I think it's pretty amazing that this horrible event happened in 1836. And as you write in the book, just before The Searchers was written as a novel and released as a film, after all these years of history had gone by, there was a meeting between the Parker families and the Comanche descendants of Cynthia Ann's son, Quanah Parker. And over the years now, they've come to where they have family reunions and they attend each other's family events, as you write in the book. They even, you know, offer tokens of appreciation over the years to each other. That's really pretty amazing.
It's a great American story. Early on, I got to go to one of the Comanche family reunions in 2008, and they were so generous and welcoming. And, you know, they held powwows. They did various things right at a place called the Star House, which was Quanah Parker's home, which is still standing in Cache, Oklahoma. And so right away, you could see from their point of view how much they venerated their ancestors, both Quanah and Cynthia Ann. And then to go to the Texas reunion a couple of weeks later, and again, you're right, there were emissaries back and forth. They trade a silver bowl every year. They share these ancestors, and they share the story, and they tell it slightly differently, some of them. But nonetheless, they know that this is, you know, that this is what grounds them and their family in American history. And it gives it a, you know, I've gone back 3 times to reunions since then. It really becomes a contemporary event with meaning, I think, to this day, because how was America built, after all? Out of this terrible war, out of these terrible struggles, and yet today we are one nation. We have a president who comes from 2 different backgrounds, and in the same way, many of the Parkers have 1 foot in the Comanche world and 1 foot in the Texan or the white world. That kind of blend is what America's all about, and I found it to be a very resonant, and I closed the book with that because, to me, it's very resonant about who we are and basically how we got here.
Glenn Frankel is a professor of journalism at the University of Texas in Austin. He's the author of The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend. He spoke to TPR's Nathan Cohn from the KUT studios in Austin. To hear an extended version of the interview and to read an excerpt from the book, go online to tpr.org. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Send your emails about the program to texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs on our website, tpr.org, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.